Okay, so the introduction is going to be given by Jamo. He's a founding member of the Socialist Workers League of the fusion between the Revolutionary Socialist Party and Socialist Alternative a few years ago. He was for a long time the secretary of the Miners' Union in Rothbury in Tasmania, and then moved over to the Fremantle Wharves, and was the chair of the rank and file committee that helped to get Christy Kane elected in 2003. So he has a wealth of experience that he's going to draw on for this introduction. He'll talk for a while, as is Jamo's wont, and then we'll have time for discussion afterwards. So, you know, if you have any questions and other interjections, leave it to the discussion. All right.
Thanks.
Oh, make them welcome.
Thanks very much. Started to get a cold, so I don't know whether I'll be speaking for the 4 hours that I had planned. Just imagine, if you would, that you're a wharfie and up in a crane or in a straddle or an internal truck, and it's night shift, and all of a sudden, over the edge of the wharf comes people with balaclavas, security guards with dogs. And all sorts of figures trying to get you out of the cranes, out of the vehicles, and saying you're virtually sacked out the gate. Well, that happened 20 years ago, almost to the day, at Webnock, just down the road from here, and it led to an explosion of anger towards not only Corrigan, the manager the owner of Patrick's, the Stevedoring company that was having the dispute with the MUA, but also an explosion of anger against the Howard government. Within days, there were tens of thousands of people on a community picket line, not only in Melbourne, but in other places throughout Australia. In Fremantle, it was about a year before I got there, but and also in Sydney and in Brisbane. But all over Australia, there were mass meetings of unionists and people who were very concerned about what was to happen with the Patrick's workforce. People were calling for action. The ACTU finally came in and endorsed the community pickets that were happening on the wharves. And it was probably the biggest dispute that had happened in decades, probably since the Clary O'Shea jailing in 1969. And it's also set a benchmark even now for what can actually happen on the wharves. That's some of the discussion that I want to try and promote towards the end of this talk about the outcome of the dispute and the lessons that we can learn from it. But just to paint the picture of how it all began to happen, when the Howard government was elected in 1995, he set out the agenda of trying to smash the unions, directly smash the unions. He introduced the Workplace Relations Act, introduced individual contracts to try and wean people away from the union movement, and he thought that he and his Employment Relations Minister, Peter Reith, decided that the best way to take on the union movement at that particular time was a major direct assault against the most radical of the unions, and that was the Maritime Union of Australia. In order to do that, they went into a conspiracy that has yet to be disproved with Chris Corrigan from Patrick's, who was determined to try and end a lot of the practices, to try and increase the productivity on his wharf, because he alleged that wharfies were lazy, and he wanted to break the power of the union on the wharves. And the conspiracy began to develop in late 1997. We first found out about it through various whistleblowers, I guess, that he was attempting to try and get people of the Australian Defence Forces, current and past members of the SAS, to train up as crane drivers in Dubai. And when that was found out, there was a not so much of a hullabaloo in December 1997, but fortunately that was knocked on the head with the action of the international union movement, who did play a role in the whole dispute, but the international union movement forced the Dubai government to cancel the visas of these SAS people training in Dubai to try and replace MUA labour, the crane drivers in particular, the key crane drivers on the wharves. But that didn't end the push by Corrigan to try and to break the union, and the, conspired again with Peter Reith and John Howard. Another way to try and break the union was to force them off the wharf and put scab labour in their place. One of the ways he was able to do it, and it's a very complicated legal process, but instead of having Patrick's directly employ his workforce, he set up four shelf companies, if you like, that had no assets at all. So if anything did happen, they were able to say that there was no money available to pay the wharfies, and therefore these companies had every right to move against them and sack them. And that's precisely what happened on April the 7th, not only in Melbourne, but right throughout Australia. Patrick's workforce was 1,400 people. Of that, many were permanent. There were quite a few casuals there as well, and it led, as I said before, to a massive outpouring of support for the Maritime Union that continued to build up and frighten not only Patrick's and Peter Reith and John Howard in the Liberal government. It also began to frighten other employers, and so the settlements were, as I'll explain a little bit later on, were laid out. Just want to go through a bit of a description of what happened with these community pickets. It was started a little bit earlier than that, with when Patrick's made some of their dock space available to a scab stevedoring company that was set up by the National Farmers Federation. And quite a number of Patrick's workers in Melbourne at that particular stage were locked out, and they began a community picket, which tootled along a little bit until the sackings occurred right throughout Australia. But I want to describe, if I can, three of these work sites and what happened on them. There's a lot of stories, and I'm sure some of the wharfies that are here have got their own stories about what transpired on this community picket and around. The not only on these three or four places I want to mention and tell some of the stories from them, but when I was in Tasmania, just finishing up in the mining industry, even in sleepy old Devonport, there was a meeting of 300 people who came out in defence and called for action in defence of the MUA. The Patricks had a very, very small presence in Tasmania at that time. I was on the picket line there for a while about 17 Patricks workers there that had been sacked, and they set up a continual picket in Devonport. But the real main places of action were Fremantle, Melbourne and Sydney. There was a community picket in Brisbane, but that wasn't effectively run, and they were able to get scab trucks or trucks going in and out and shifting the Patrick's work. When the scabs appeared on the wharf, of course, that was like a red flag to a bull, and there was just within days there were tens of thousands of people on a 24-hour picket here in Melbourne and in Fremantle and Sydney. I don't know that much about the Sydney's situation, but it was a pretty effective picket up there. They were able to stop the trucks going in and out of the wharf, taking containers in and out of the wharf, effectively holding up a lot of the work that the Patricks, a lot of the ships that Patricks were servicing. It was such a massive picket that even the cops were a little bit scared about the picketers, and apparently one particular day up in 20 years ago in Sydney, there were about 135 coppers took sickies. Wharfies are pretty well known as, well, we're obviously known as lazy and incompetent and so on, but some of them are pretty heavy guys, so I don't blame the cops for backing off. But I want to talk a little bit about Fremantle before I come back to Melbourne. Melbourne was the main site that there was mass picketing, but in Fremantle it was pretty hairy as well. For the first time, the state government, which was a Liberal government then, having its own dispute with its the state's workforce, there was a very hairy situation. Even the tactical response group were used to try and smash up the picket line there. We know that the tactical response group were training down to the South Fremantle Oval and going through some pretty heavy sort of training, which not only excited but alarmed those on the picket line. But at various stages during the picket in Fremantle, you had the helicopters going over at night, you had fixed-wing aircraft, you had a massive presence of coppers, and you had the threats from the National Farmers Federation who were going to come down and break up the picket line. One particular story that was told to me when I started work in 1999 by guys at DP World was that when they were on the picket line, after they finished work, they'd be all down the picket line, and they heard that the National Farmers Federation were mobilising. It was all over the papers that they were mobilising to come down and break up the picket. And they get these reports all the time. They're at, they're right out in the eastern suburbs at Midland at the moment, and then about half an hour later, they're a bit further in, they're in at Bassendean, and people were getting themselves geared up, learning how to link arms and lock fingers to prevent them. But in the end, it all failed to materialise. But there was one time when the cops did move in on the picket lines to smash them up, and for the first time, and I think the only time in the whole dispute, DP World workers who were directly involved in the sackings marched out the gate to defend their comrades in Patrick's. I don't think the DP World workers, at that time they were called P&O, P&O Ports, I don't think they were involved in any other industrial action other than living themselves to help the picketers. But when that began, there are other stories that were told with much glee when I started that, because Patrick's is right next to P&O Ports, DP World. Instead of working for the shift, there was quite a few people at the fence line with what they call twist locks, which are pretty heavy sort of things, throwing them over the fence every time a forklift or a truck would appear, so there'd be a lot of wrecked vehicles going past. But when the what they were very worried about is if they did break the picket line, the scabs would be throwing them back pretty soon at the DP World, at the P&O, P&O workers. So that was a bit about Fremantle and just the enormous amount of public support. Again, with just about everywhere that happened, there were telephone trees, anything that would begin to occur, no matter what the time of day, these telephone trees were set into operation, and within hours you'd have thousands down on the picket line. It was described in the Western Australian at one time as it looked like a war zone down there. Right, Melbourne was probably the epicentre of the struggle, where Corrigan really decided to try and make his mark. It was a community picket that the MUA were injuncted on, but no one ever ignored that. And what you had the usual things with, there were barbecues set up, there was portaloos sent in, there was tents, and there was music going. People, musicians would come and give their time for free to keep the morale up of the picketers. But there was a mass picketing effort. At stages, there were 10,000 people on the picket line. And on one particular night, they call it the Night of the Long Knives, the picketers were facing cops. There were rumours that the city watch house had been emptied out, which never happened before, but had been emptied out in order for those in the picket line who were to be arrested to be thrown in. And there were about 400 cops turned up to try and break the picket line. They also came across a thing that something down on the picket line that metal workers had done. It's a community art project where they welded together railway lines, and it was a beautiful structure, but it just happened to serve as a barricade as well. So I think that's a wonderful little initiative that was taken. But this Night of the Long Knives was probably the culmination, you know, was the high point. There were the tensions and the excitement and the trepidation was very real at that time as thousands were confronting the police. And it was getting towards dawn and they were waiting for the police to charge or waiting for things to happen. But as dawn broke, the entire city CBD, the CFMEU, the construction workers walked off the job, quite illegally, walked off the job and came down to help the picket line. But in order to get to the picket line, they had to come in behind the cops. So what had happened on the night, or on that morning, the cops were penned in, kettled. I loved coming back the other way. And so the cops were literally surrounded by tens of thousands, pretty angry people who were determined to keep the picket line going. And in the end, the cops had to concede defeat, had to ask for permission from the picket line so they could walk off in an orderly fashion. So the great cheers, they walked off in single file, like wild ducks through the picket line in order to get away from it. But I don't really want to go into all the legal arguments around it because they're pretty complicated and it doesn't really matter to so much of this talk. But in the end, it was conceded by the courts that the MUA had the right to represent its members. And so it was a great victory for the MUA when it actually happened. The MUA, and that's where the slogan, the MUA Here to Stay, originated from. But the effect was of the mass picketing that had occurred forced the courts or made the courts very aware that they weren't going to accept anything less to defend the Patrick's workers, and the MUA was granted, although it was appealed and appealed, but eventually granted the right to represent workers on the job at Patrick's. But the outcome wasn't, and this is where the real discussion and debates have happened ever since, outcome wasn't as rosy as we could perhaps imagine. Everyone was excited that the MUA was protected. It wasn't smashed and driven off the wharves. But unfortunately for the people at Patrick's, a lot of the things that Corrigan wanted industrially from his own workforce was accepted by the eventual negotiations and peace settlement that took place even about 3 or 4 months after the initial attack on the MUA. It meant that half the Patrick's workforce were made redundant. There were a lot of productivity increases that the union allowed. There was casualisation, which has been a bugbear ever since came onto the wharf, and of course P&O, who acted all innocent during the whole dispute, picking up an enormous amount of work from Patrick's right through the dispute, began to introduce casualisation and the other givebacks that Patrick had won from its workforce. So there was, even though there was a bit of dispute within the ranks of the MUA, the effect of that were very have still now very much felt in the stevedoring industry amongst wharfies. Casualisation in particular, I know there'll probably be discussion about what's happening at Cuba at the moment down in the wharves down here, but casualisation is a real pain in the arse for anyone. For the 13 years I worked at DP World in Fremantle, I was never made up to, I don't know why, but I was never made up to be a permanent worker, so I had to rely on ringing up every day to find out what I'm doing the next day. And if you cannot live any sort of decent, normal social life and continually worried about finances, and that was not just me, but for the many hundreds of people who have been affected by that in the stevedoring industry. But I want to just, if I can, go step back a little bit and talk about the strategy and tactics, because that's very relevant to whether you could call the end of the dispute a victory or a defeat, or a defeat that was snatched from the jaws of victory. But I want to talk about strategy and tactics, because I think that can be the misconceptions around strategy and tactics can either be used maliciously or inadvertently or innocently, and if you don't get it right, you can get yourself into real strife when you're going through any sort of campaign. Now, obviously, people here have been involved in all sorts of campaigns, industrial campaigns, campaigns around women's rights, around same-sex marriage. Everyone's been involved in a campaign, I'm sure, that's sitting here. So strategy and tactics are very important when you go into a campaign. And knowing the difference between the two is also very important. I think a lot of disputes have been lost either maliciously or unintentionally because they do mix up tactics and strategy. Strategy gives you an aim, an overall aim that you're able to mobilise the resources and the sources that you've got in order to win a campaign. It involves the clear, very clear demands that you want to win against your employer or against the government. And it's not just a collection of tactics. It goes a little bit beyond that. It sets the goal and the framework in which your campaign is to be run. Tactics are very much subordinate to the overall strategy. Tactics, you can use a whole range of different tactics, and some tactics can be very, very important. Others, you can be very flexible about. That particular tactic doesn't work. You've got the ability then within that framework of your strategy to pull back and use other tactics or a conjunction of other tactics in order to win. Now, that sounds a little bit general and so on, but if you start looking at what happened to the Patrick's dispute, where tactics and strategies were confused, you can begin to see where the problems arose for the workforce and the plans of the union leadership because of their particular outlook on the whole thing began to play. The dispute very much, and it was called, it was a new thing, if you like, ideas that introduced by Combe, who was at that time in the ACTU, and Bill Kelty, who was still in the ACTU, and the leadership of the MUA, called strategic unionism. They were coming across a tactic that wouldn't necessarily use industrial tactics to win. It became more and more a legal thing that you had to go and win it in the courts because you had to show that you were responsible and you were playing by the rules, whereas the government and Chris Corrigan weren't playing by the rules. So they were using it. I'm not saying that you shouldn't use any sort of legal avenues that you've got, but this legal tactic became, in the end, a strategy for the union leadership to try and win the dispute. I mean, more and more it became concentrated only on protecting the MUA, and that protected union officials' jobs, of course. So it was that was the beginning of the problem with the legal tactic. Other things like the conditions that on the wharves were subordinated in order to get the MUA as the proper representative of the workforce. So it began to skew the perspective of the campaign from taking them on industrially, using the enormous amount of support that was there in the community to try and break not only the break Corrigan and Reith's plans for the watersale workers, but begin to break all the laws or break through the laws that had been imposed upon the union, the Workplace Relations Act, the Trades Practices Act, and the secondary boycotts, which were an important thing weapon that the government was going to use against were attempting to use against the MUA. We can't do anything outside the rules back then. But if you look at the dispute itself, even that example I used of the Night of the Long Knives, that was an illegal strike for the construction workers to walk off the job and to come down and protect the picket. No one was charged with that. No one dared charge them for that walking off the job illegally. It was a secondary boycott. There's no other way to put it. So even the pleas of the union officials and the ACTU to say, well, we're holding back, we're just waiting for, you can't move the whole campaign forward by taking on the government. That was shown to be a bit of a lie by the actual things that occurred on the job. The problem with elevating a tactic, as I mentioned before, to that of a strategy, and it becomes the major aim. It excludes all excludes all other tactical responses that you can have. So the industrial side of it, they didn't dare take out the P&O workers, for instance, to defend their rights in the end against casualisation or the attempts to increase productivity in the wars at the expense of jobs. That wasn't a consideration of the MUA leadership. In fact, they were very worried that they would muddy the waters, if you like, with P&O management if they took out the P&O workers. And the P&O workers were very, very supportive of the... They would have come out at the drop of a hat in order to defend the Patrick's workers. So the defeat and the victory and defeat, if you like, in the end was, a mistaken approach by the MUA leadership, but they were very determined, and their whole approach, if you like, to negotiations in the war had been shaped a lot earlier. With the accord that Hawke and Keating had introduced 10 years earlier, it became the benchmark of approaches of the union movement towards industrial campaigning. In order for holding back on industrial action, you began to, in favour, to try and get something out of a social wage, you began to forget all about industrial campaigning at all. And that's something that still affects us all today. And the union movement suffered enormously because of that, because they don't, by and large, don't know how to fight. They never use industrial tactics to any real degree for many, many years. And, of course, union membership has declined enormously because of that. So that was one of the problems that with the campaign around trying to fight Reith and Howard and Corrigan was the push towards the legal strategies or making a legal tactic the main aim in the campaign and subordinate everything else to that. But there are other things that other two major things that Tom Bramble, who wrote a very good pamphlet on the war on the waterfront, the MUA dispute, soon after the whole battle was over. And incidentally, his pamphlet is still like a benchmark, if you like, of people who wanted to debate out the question. Even recently, there was a book put out in Perth, Radical Perth Militant Fremantle, that refers to the 1998 dispute and it takes up the contentions that Tom Bramble put forward. But Tom also pointed out not only the problems with the legal strategy, but also the problems of relying on the Labor Party, or putting everything in the court of a future Labor government will resolve everything. So you don't want to upset the apple cart with regard to the ALP parliamentarians. So there's always a constant deference to the Labor Party, whether it's in power, out of power, whether it's federally or state-wise. And you can see this today with the campaign, say, around the change the rules. It was originally break the rules, but now it's change the rules. And the only people who can change the rules is the Labor Party. Doesn't matter if the Labor Party doesn't say they're going to change the rules, but it's something that you've got to pull back on and just hope that the anger that is expressed towards the Tories results in a Labor government, and let's just hope and pray that they're going to do something for us. Well, yeah, we can see what's happened over the last, for many, many decades with the advent of a Labor government. They might give a little bit of, throw a few crumbs your way, but not take on the whole question about the industrial laws at the moment, and virtually making striking illegal in Australia. So it was that was also a problem. The ALP officials, Kim Beazley was the opposition leader at that particular time, was never seen in the picket line. In fact, he was saying, I can mediate the whole thing out for you, right from the very beginning. And then only after weeks after the dispute began and the picket lines were massive, you just start to see the ALP figures begin to appear on the... And I knew it was just they'd have to do something in order to preserve the credibility amongst working people. They began to appear on the picket lines. The other major problem that Tom pointed to, and I think it was a real thing, it was if you're having a genuine campaign, any sort of industrial campaign, you have to have a rank and file that's not only informed about what's happening, they have to be involved, and the decisions they make are the ones that you really do listen to and take forward. It is true there were quite a number of meetings that the MUA held with its own amongst the Patrick's workers, but that was really just to tell them what they knew, and the state officials that sometimes didn't even know what was going on legally because it was so complicated, and they were waiting for the judges to make some decision that the Patrick's workers were and the MUA in general weren't fully aware what was happening, and any discussion or debate or alternatives that were put forward were actively discouraged. You've got to be disciplined. You've got to follow what your union leaders are telling you, rather than discussing them out and saying, "Well, that is a good idea. That's a bad idea. Let's have a vote on it and make our own way forward." In the dispute, and that's always been a bugbear, a problem for the union movement, is if they don't involve the rank and file, you are limiting your possibilities of coming out on top. It's not to say that every union official is a complete arsehole. Maybe some good people, but no, if you really give the control of the dispute over to the rank and file, it means that you have a very, very good case for that solidarity, that discipline to be really enforced in a very proper manner. Okay,
I'll go for it.
I could stay here for hours, but some of the pictures you've seen on the wall are from the from 20 years ago. I'm not going to go through each. Probably a Wharfie sitting there, but. Go through each picture, but it just gives you a flavour for the whole thing. So just to wrap up, and I know the discussion that will take place will probably centre a lot on what's happening in the walls at the moment, because there are similar disputes beginning that had their roots back in 1998 appearing again in the wharf. That's always been the case for the last 20 years, particularly around casualisation. No matter how the union has fought, and we've fought back against some of the worst aspects of casualisation. When I was a delegate for the P&O, we were able to abolish some layers of casualisation, give some sort of guaranteed income to the casuals, varied salaried employees, VSEs instead of GWEs or PNGs, or there's a whole range of different categories. But what we're seeing now is supplementary is being used far, far more. These are the poor bastard right on the bottom of the pile. The ship comes in, they need excess labour, they will just bring up a labour hire company, pick up three or four people, and they might get a job once a fortnight, if that. And this is a real problem for the MUA, and I'm sure that discussion will take place. But just to go back and to round off the discussion about 1998, it was an exhilarating time for those who were involved in it. It wasn't really... No one really expected such a massive outpouring of support for wharfies back then, because wharfies had the image, and they were union thugs. They were lazy, they were thieves, they were... they'd do anything for the nick, which... I'd do anything for a nick too. I like... When the ship's finished and there's nothing else can be done, you just went home and got paid for it. Or your walk-up starts, that's when you go to work and there's just no work to be done, and you go home and get paid for it. But they're very, very hard to come by now. And there was always had problems with the nick, because sometimes you bent rules in order to go home early. But that was one thing that Chris Corrigan really hated, was the Fremantle nick where everyone took off. Anyway, you don't really see that that occurring again anymore. And a lot of other conditions on the wars have changed dramatically. In fact, I can't go back further than 1999 on the wars, but the whole culture has been radically altered on the wars now. And it's again with, you know, casuals fighting against the permanents, and being the permanents being used against the casuals, and the casuals amongst themselves be divided about you know, how far up the ladder they can actually go. It's a scenario that is not good for unionism at the moment, and that's got to be something that's broken down. But what is I want to really emphasise again is the support for industrial campaigning and campaigning against laws that Turnbull now has, the many different laws, the different ways that they're trying to interpret the Fair Work Act, the fact that the Fair Work Commissions can now come down and say that even legal strikes can be deemed illegal, making it virtually impossible to strike legally at all. These laws can be broken and must be broken, and not relying on what a future Labor government may or may not do, but broken now, because there's a real distrust of the industrial agenda of the big business at the moment, and the support they get from the Liberal National Government. So I'll end it there and just really open it up for discussion and debate and whatever.
Great, thanks, John.